soul. Join me Mondays at noon as we explore the universal energy that connects us all. Let's discuss our journey of self-discovery, joy, presence, and living with authenticity. We can create positive change in the world, and it starts within each one of us. Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Mondays at noon on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Hello and welcome to Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard. Thanks so much for being with me today. This is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, or you might be listening in Kamloops at CFBX or online at CITR.ca, CosmicDimensions.com, EmpowerRadio.com, or on the Co-Creator Network. And wherever you're listening from, thanks for being with us. I have a very special guest today. He is Brian Rue, author of A Short Walk on an Ancient Path, a Buddhist exploration of meditation, karma, and rebirth. And he's actually the author of a few books. And this one is Feeling of the Buddha. And you have a website as well. That's actually how we met, because we went to a meetup group about website optimization.
That's right.
And there were only two websites that they reviewed. One was mine. And the other was yours.
It was meant to be.
It was. And so what is your website again?
It's Theravada.ca.
Wonderful.
Which is hard for people to spell, but it means the Theravada tradition of Buddhism, like in Thailand, Burma, Sri Lanka.
And that's T-H-E-R?
A, and then V-A-D-A.ca.
Wonderful. Yeah. So you are an expert. I don't know if you'd call yourself an expert in Buddhism, but I think a lot of people would. So how did you get started in Buddhism?
Yeah, well, I guess I wouldn't call myself a scholar or an expert, but I've been at it for, oh, I guess, well, 22 years ago it began, actually, 1991 here in Vancouver. I took a course because my roommate at the time, Bruce Wilson, he said, let's take this course on Buddhist psychology at the Shambhala Center in Vancouver. So that's how it all began for me.
Wonderful. And that's just down the street from my house, actually. I think it's on, like, 16th and Heather, right?
Yeah, 16th and Heather, yeah. Between 17th and Heather, 16th, that block.
Yeah, so you went there. And what year was that?
This was 1991. It was January the 14th, 1991, a Monday night. I still remember it. So I clicked with it almost right away and decided that was it for me. This is my path.
Awesome. Yeah. And there's a picture of you in Thailand. So tell me about your trip to Thailand.
Well, yeah. How did I get from Vancouver to Thailand?
Yeah.
Well, I was taking courses here for a year. I was quite inspired. And then I decided to move to the big Shambhala Center in Vermont called Karma Trolling. So I moved there in 1992. So I left my girlfriend. I quit my job. I was selling mutual funds. I was working as a financial planner. So my friends were quite surprised that I actually took this bold step on my real spiritual journey. So I was there, and I really enjoyed the center in Vermont. But I was Canadian. I could only stay for 6 months. So after that, I decided, well, not many to do. I decided to head off to Nepal, because I was actually a Tibetan Buddhist at that time. But my friends in Vermont, they said, well, you know, the food's and the water's pretty bad in Nepal. You're going to get sick. So you should go to Thailand first for a couple of months, do some retreats to get acclimatized, and then go to Nepal.
Hmm.
So that's how I got to Thailand, but I stayed.
And how long did you stay in Thailand?
Almost 4 years.
Wow.
Yeah, I wasn't planning on this, but I kind of fell in love with Thailand. I did some retreats, and then I converted to the Theravada school tradition of Buddhism, sort of the opposite end of the spectrum from Tibetan Buddhism.
So what's the difference between Theravada and Tibetan Buddhism?
Well, you could say, I guess from at least from the perspective of scholars and historians who study this, I would say Theravada is the least changed form, or oldest, perhaps purest form of Buddhism. And Tibetan Buddhism grew out of a schism about 400 years after the Buddha. This was the rise of Mahayana Buddhism. So the two major schools, Theravada and Mahayana. So it was a later development from a schism. So it changed quite a bit.
Okay, thank you. Well, yeah. I want to talk about some of the specifics around Buddhism, because in your book, A Short Walk on an Ancient Path, you talk about the Four Noble Truths, how to meditate, the Eightfold Path. Like, there's a whole bunch of things that you talk about.
Sure.
So can we have a little mini lesson on Buddhism?
Sure,
today?
Don't cost nothing. Sure, you want me to just start off with the Buddhism 101
lesson? Sure, yeah.
Well, gee, okay. Well, I would say perhaps the most common way of you know, describing the Buddha's teachings, or what he taught, is the Four Noble Truths. This was the Buddha's first formal discourse. So he attained enlightenment at the age of 35, and he lived in India about 5th century BC, and he taught for 45 years, age of 80. So he always emphasized and stated these Four Noble Truths again in different ways, different patterns, different formats. But essentially, you can say the teachings of the Buddha, the Buddha himself said, I only teach two things. I teach the fact that we suffer, the nature of suffering, and the path to the end of suffering. So he was just concerned with guiding people to the path to the end of suffering.
So what are the Four Noble Truths then?
Yeah, the Four Noble Truths are a bit more of an elaboration of the two. The fact that you suffer and there's an end to it, a way to the end. So the first of the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha said, is that there is, he used this term, dukkha, because the Buddha's teachings are translated from the Pali language. So if you really want to be accurate about Buddhist terms, we go back to the Pali term. So some Pali terms don't translate that easily. The word dukkha is usually translated as suffering, that life is of the nature of suffering, or there's suffering in life. But it has a wider meaning of that. But that's basically the first noble truth, that we have impermanence, change, insubstantiality, unsatisfactoriness. No matter what you have, there's still some sense of dissatisfaction with it, or kind of an existential angst. It's like that feeling in the bottom of your stomach that, you know, anything could happen, and I don't know if I can take it. that's dukkha. Yeah.
So, my next question then is, do you still experience dukkha, or has it subsided?
Who, me? On my spiritual level? Yeah, I guess I still experience some dukkha. I would say it has, in a sense, it has subsided somewhat. Yeah, I would say I have less anxiety. Back in my 20s, like, I discovered Buddhism when I was 31, and 53 now. Back in my 20s, I had more uncertainty, nervousness, self-consciousness, worried more, you know, thought a lot, worried. So now a lot of that, at least part of that, has subsided. I'm a bit more relaxed, detached, and just more at home with my own life, a bit more at comfort, you know, at ease with myself.
Nice.
Yeah.
So dukkha is one part of the Four Noble Truths.
Yeah, it's the first noble truth.
And so the first noble truth is that everyone has dukkha?
Yeah, basically all beings have this dukkha. Until you get enlightened, yeah, we all have some degree of dukkha, either, you know, mild or gross. It's more emotional or mental suffering. It's not so much, you know, just physical pain, which is dukkha as well. But, you know, even in the best of health, with lots of money and wealth, people feel depressed, anxious, worried, suicidal. So yeah, it's more of the mental, emotional state. This is what the Buddha is really addressing, matters of the heart. Really, you could say Buddhism is a religion of emotion, really.
Hmm.
It's about your emotional life, how you feel. Like, how does it feel?
And what's the next noble truth?
The next noble truth is the cause of your suffering, Marie. The cause of your suffering is unwholesome desire. Like clinging and attachment, always wanting, craving, desiring things to make you happy.
So how was that, how has unwholesome desire changed for you since you've been a Buddhist?
Well, I guess I still have unwholesome desire, but I see it and also realize that it's not really leading to any real genuine happiness. You know, it's not really leading to a genuine satisfaction. So at least I don't venerate my unwholesome desires as much. You know, I can see through them a bit more. So I feel my own experience. I practice more the middle way in my life, the avoidance of extremes, which was the first insight the Buddha shared when he taught. He taught the avoidance of the extreme of sensuous indulgence and the avoid the extreme of self-denial, self-mortification. So I've done pretty good in terms of diet and exercise and everything else, just keeping in the middle of the road, like the way I drive, right down the yellow line there.
Wonderful. So what is the third one, the third noble truth?
Well, the third noble truth is there is such a thing as the cessation of suffering, the end of dukkha, which is full and complete enlightenment, or nirvana. You've probably heard of Kurt Cobain's band from Seattle,
yes.
Nirvana.
It didn't seem like they really experienced much Nirvana.
Well, probably not, yes. So the Buddha had described the third noble truth before describing the fourth noble truth, but that there is it is actually possible to bring suffering to an end, all mental, emotional suffering to an end. So he described nirvana or enlightenment as the highest bliss, highest happiness, highest peace. And it's also a permanent state.
Hmm.
It's once you've arrived there, you'll never slip back into the sleep of ego ever again. It's an ultimate permanent state, and you finally, your spiritual work is done after, from a Buddhist view, countless lifetimes it takes us to get there.
But isn't the pursuit of nirvana something that could also cause suffering? Just your awareness of not having it?
Oh, it's so paradoxical. Well, I guess that's true. It could. Because the Buddha, he did differentiate between this unwholesome desire and wholesome desire. So wholesome desire is, say, the desire to practice meditation, desire to, you know, follow a spiritual path or to restrain your negative emotions. But the difficulty, I think, for people is to distinguish, you know, what if their attentions are wholesome and what are unwholesome? You think something's good and you find out later, well, it's really unwholesome. But to get enlightened, you do need some aspiration. You need some desire to follow that spiritual path, to really make an effort on the spiritual path. So desire is good as long as it's wholesome desire.
Okay. Yeah. Wonderful. And then, so you had mentioned, now, did you mention the fourth noble truth? Because nirvana, and there was...
Well, you know, I was getting to that. So that's really the fourth noble truth is there is a way to the cessation of suffering. This is the noble eightfold path that the Buddha taught. So really the fourth noble truth is the Buddhist religion. It's the eight aspects of the Buddha's teachings that basically encompass everything he taught in his 45-year career. So it's quite a systematic path, and it breaks it down into three stages of the path, which is sort of a Buddhism in a nutshell.
Wonderful. Well, I am curious to ask you about the Eightfold Path. It's time for a break in just a moment.
Okay.
And then you also were going to do a five-minute...
Yeah, like loving-kindness guided
kindness.
Meditation.
Yeah.
Sure, for the audience.
And you also have some meditations on your YouTube page.
Yeah, I've got like 200 YouTube videos now.
Wonderful.
I've got some guided meditations there for people for free, sure.
And your YouTube is youtube.com/BrianRuhe, R-U-H-E. And the website is Theravada.
Yeah, we don't pronounce H. Yeah,
okay.
Theravada.
Theravada, but it's spelled Theravada.
Yeah.
Theravada.ca is the website. And you've got workshops coming up and all that and something happening tonight. So I will ask you about that after the break. And
okay.
If you want to get on the air and ask Brian a question, 604-822-2487. We will be back with more synchronicity momentarily.
$1 billion on the ground, all stretched out and uncurled, would extend about four times around the circumference of the world.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Commercial Drive area at
Bone Rattle Music Limited, High Life Records.
I was a prisoner.
Cocaine addiction.
Cocaine took my drink. It made me lie, steal.
Cocaine took my will, my soul.
And all I wanted was more cocaine. Cocaine Anonymous gave me freedom and saved my life. If you got a problem with cocaine, pick up the phone. We're here to help.
Contact Cocaine Anonymous toll-free by calling 866-662-8300. Or find them online at ca-bc.ca.
Welcome back to Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I am your host, Marie Bernard. Thank you so much for being with us today. And today we're joined by Brian Rue. He is from Theravada.ca. And what is it? It's like a community, right? What's Theravada.ca all about?
Well, the website is called the Theravada Buddhist Community of Vancouver, which is basically just my classes and guest teachers and also links to other Theravadan temples in the city. Yeah.
Wonderful. And so you have something going on tonight, Monday, at your house.
That's right. I have a Monday night ongoing meditation group from 7:30 to 9. It's a drop-in by donation, and anyone's welcome. You know, usually people come after they've taken a course, you know, a bit about meditation, they come to the ongoing group. But anyone's welcome. Some people already have meditation experience.
Great. Yeah. And you have an event also happening this coming weekend?
That's right. I have a weekend retreat. I do this every few months. It just happens to be this weekend, Marie. Holy smokes.
Woohoo!
This is way out in... Aldergrove is not that far, just a 1 hour drive down the number one highway. So it's very conveniently located just outside of Vancouver. And it's at a Laotian temple. So they let me use the space. So it's an overnight retreat, Friday night and Saturday night till Sunday at 4. So we start at 7:30 p.m. Friday night.
So it's like a Buddhist sleepover party.
It's a sleepover party, yeah. We have 18 of us so far.
Nice.
So there's room for a maximum about 25. So, yeah, the info is on my website at theravada.ca. If anybody wants to come, they can email me. We can still fit them in.
Cool. Yeah. And so what's going to happen in this overnight sleepover?
Well, we're going to sit, do sitting meditation, and then do walking meditation, and then do sitting meditation, do walking meditation, sit, walk. So periods of about 45 minutes sitting and like 20 minute walking, sort of alternating periods, and some guided meditation and a few talks. And Saturday night, I have this tradition, this is my sixth weekend at this temple, where we just have question and answer as long as people want to go. So we went from 8 to 11 p.m. last couple of times, on into the night.
Wow.
Any question, philosophical question, Buddhism, meditation. Yeah.
Nice. What's your favorite philosophical question to answer?
I like it talking about karma and rebirth.
Yeah.
Because it's really a core Buddhist concept. Yeah.
Well, so what's more important to talk about first, Eightfold Path or karma and rebirth?
Maybe karma and rebirth.
Okay.
Because it cuts right to the core of the view. Because actually the first on the Buddha's Eightfold Path is right view, which means the view of reality that Buddha apprehended under the Bodhi tree. You've probably heard of the night of the Buddha's enlightenment is under this Bodhi tree. And he described enlightenment as a moment like bang. So at the very core of that, he said in one of the discourses of Buddha, they're called suttas, he said, right view is karma and rebirth. So actually what defines a Buddhist is having some conviction in just two things, and that's karma and rebirth. That's actually the definition of a Buddhist.
Is that you believe in karma and
and
an afterlife or a reincarnation.
Rebirth. Yeah, you might. Of course, we don't know from our own experience, but recognize we don't know if that's true. But we have some conviction about it. Maybe a belief or basically it's a hypothesis that you're choosing to follow because it's a safe way to live your life in accordance with that law. So it keeps you out of trouble. Even if you don't know it's true from your direct experience, it is like the Buddhist word sada, it's translated as faith, but sada basically means a reasoned conviction. So you have a reasonable conviction that this is a good hypothesis to follow. Hmm. Or you could call it belief. Yeah, yeah. So that's what defines a Buddhist. Some people get upset with me when I say this because I know people have been going on these Buddhist meditation retreats over the last 20 years. A lot of them, they just don't believe in life after death. They just don't. So I said, sorry, you know, you can't join the club, you know, you can't be a Buddhist if you don't. This just the Buddha's criteria.
Do you have to have like a strong belief in it or can you, I mean, because I believe it's certainly possible. I'm not going to discount the possibility, but I don't know.
It doesn't have to be strong, I guess, mainly just to be open to the possibility. Yeah. Okay. But, you know, Marie, if you don't believe in rebirth in this lifetime, you'll believe it in your next lifetime. But you
funny.
Do a spirituality show right here in this show.
I
you
do.
Must get all kinds of spiritual ideas.
Right? I do. And it's very confusing because everyone has a different idea.
It must be confusing.
And even with karma and rebirth, everyone has a different idea of what that looks like.
Yeah.
Some people believe that you move from like being a snail to a squirrel and then you move up like that. And other people believe that they were like Cleopatra in one life now they're. So what's your view on that?
But the Buddha, he did teach quite a precise and thorough view of karma and rebirth. And it was different than the Hindus or Brahmins of his time. He was very much, you know, challenged the Brahmins and Hindus of his time. They had all kinds of different ideas. Like, for instance, Your rebirth is just dependent upon your caste. So if you're in the highest Brahmin caste, well, you go straight to the Brahmin heavens. It doesn't matter what kind of a person you were. So the Buddha, he said your rebirth is determined by your conduct. It has a big influence. Yeah, so I try to stay true to the Buddha's teachings on rebirth. I should tell your audience as well, I've got about 20 YouTube videos just on karma and rebirth. My first one from 4 years ago is on there. It's got 15,000 hits. But you can define the terms as saying karma is defined as the mental intention that initiates any action. So it's the intention that matters in your action. So but use the example, if you're walking down the street and you step on an ant, there's no karma there. You haven't broken the precept of killing because you're not even aware that you stepped on an ant. There's no negative karma. But if you see a spider and you don't like spiders and you stomp on the spider, well, that's karma. That's choosing to kill.
So what happens if I kill a spider?
You mean deliberately?
Yeah.
I think it rains for 7 days. That's what's happening in Vancouver here most of the time.
A lot of spider killers here.
But the last few weeks I've been killing spiders. it's a negative karma. It's killing. To what degree? It's certainly not as bad as killing a larger animal or killing a human being.
Okay, so yeah, that's why is it not as bad to kill a spider as it is to kill a human being? I mean, it's still a life. It still has friends and family.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure a lot of people feel that way. The Buddha did say that the amount of negative karma incurred from killing does depend on the intention and also the victim, the qualities of the victim. The Buddha even went as far as saying if you kill a really noble person, it's worse karma than just killing an ordinary schmuck or someone who's immoral. the immoral qualities. Of course, that might get some people upset saying that. So the same would relate to insects like spiders versus humans. Humans are more morally developed, so it's a greater negative karma killing a human than a spider.
Interesting. So do you ever watch Dexter?
No.
The show?
No.
Because he kills bad guys.
He heals bad guys.
If killing a bad guy is not as bad as killing a good guy,
I
then
guess that's true.
It's better karma.
Yeah.
He's making a difference in the world.
That's true. The Buddha, though, the Buddha, in terms of his, there's five basic precepts all lay people are supposed to be on. But for killing the Buddha, doesn't allow for capital punishment. He recommended the kings, he's against the idea of capital punishment. It's better to just imprison someone, you know, than to have capital punishment. So there's really no Buddhist excuse for killing.
So then are you vegan?
I'm actually vegan in between meals. Yeah, because, you know, and in fact, I should tell you, I'm so spiritual now. I only eat vegetarian animals like chickens and cows because I'm so... No, actually, the Buddha was not a vegetarian. In fact, I have a YouTube video called Vegetarians Argue with the Buddha. So you can see this argument is almost an hour long. It's filmed in Delta. So many people are quite shocked, but the Buddha never taught the idea, and the Buddha was never a vegetarian himself. Part of the reason that when monks are given food, the Buddha said, you shouldn't create a fuss for lay people, just accept whatever you're given and eat it. Unless you know an animal specifically killed for the monk, then you should refuse it. Or if you hear the cry of the animal or see it getting killed, then you have to refuse it. Otherwise, you have to eat the meat, the Buddha said. So myself, I would actually more seriously describe myself as a passive vegetarian. I tend to eat mostly vegetarian food. If somebody gives me something, you know, I'll eat the meat. Or if it's convenient for me, sometimes, like I teach classes at the New West School Board of Burnaby, and I go to the SkyTrain. The Broadway SkyTrain has this nice little pizza place, not to give a commercial plug for them. But if they have vegetarian pizza, I'll eat it. If they don't, I'll just eat whatever's there. So I think it's good to be a vegetarian, but I'm not one myself. And Theravadan Buddhists generally aren't.
No. Interesting. So if you don't kill the animal yourself and you don't hear the animal being killed, but then what about all this factory farming? I mean, we know all the incredible torture that these animals go through. Is that not bad karma to eat factory farmed food?
Well, you know, I have my own spiritual doubts about that. Because during the time of the Buddha, they had free range chicken, right, and cows. So they lived a bit of a life before they were killed. From the Buddhist view and the way the Buddha taught this, if you eat meat, there's really no negative karma. If somebody killed a chicken, well, they have the negative karma. Huh. And if you buy the chicken after it's killed, you know, and then you eat it, there's no negative karma. So
paying someone to kill an animal for you is not
negative karma, but doing it yourself, that's confusing to me.
See, this expression on your face, Maria, I've seen this, I've been teaching about 17 years here in Vancouver. This question comes up in almost every class, giving the Buddhist view on it. You wouldn't pay someone to kill a chicken, because then you're actually, it is your negative karma, you're getting someone to kill for you. But if you just go and buy chicken at the grocery store, it's not directly paying someone to actually kill a specific chicken. So then there's no negative karma from a Buddhist view. But it is negative karma for the people who kill. Actually, I lived in our Buddhist monastery in England in 2004, and the senior monk there, Ajahn Vajiro, he told me that he was a vegetarian because he was most concerned about how it affects people in the meat industry.
Yeah.
He's more concerned about their bad karma. He's more concerned about them than the animals.
Interesting.
So you got to have compassion for... But you made a good point. Like now with chickens, we have these like battery chickens, really very poorly treated, suffering. So you got to wonder. I'm not so sure there's no negative karma from eating chicken because of the way they're treated today. It's because of this corporate model, the way corporations have brought about this, saving money by battery chickens, stacking them 9 cages high. So, yeah, I have my doubts about it. But the Buddhist doctrinal view is that there's no negative karma from eating meat. The karma comes from killing.
So that's really interesting, because for me, my moral, like my values are kind of like, I mean, I do eat, unfortunately, sometimes factory farmed food. I don't seek it out, obviously, like if I can get free range, I will and all of that. But for me, if I myself killed an animal that was living in the wild and had a happy life, I don't morally think there's anything wrong with that.
If you killed an animal in the wild?
In order to eat it, if I was going to do that. Like, that's my belief system. I find I have more of a problem. I think I'm a worse person just for supporting the factory farming industry with my money than if I was to go out and murder an animal myself.
Yeah, I think that's the view of the head of Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, right? He kills his own chickens and pigs now.
Yeah.
He feels this is the morally right thing for him to do rather than someone else to do it. Yeah, but I know that the Buddhists would say, well, you still have the karma of killing the chicken. However, it's better than, say, killing for sport. Say if you just go hunting and shoot a deer and leave it there, killing for sport, that's the worst karma. So the degrees of negative karma always vary depending on the situation. It always depends, the degree of karma. But still, in your scenario you described, it would still be a negative karma of killing the chicken, eating it. And now if you have to do it to survive, some cultures, like, up in the Tibetan plateau there historically, they just had, like, yak butter and yak meat and yak milk. That's all they had, right? So there's not many vegetarians. So the degree of negative karma would probably be lower. But the whole process of killing generally involves some aversion in the mind to kill. There's some aversion in the mind there.
Interesting. So it's, and again, because you'd mentioned earlier, part of it is your intent.
Yeah.
Right. Like, what if you killed an animal that was suffering in order to alleviate its suffering?
Well, that's actually a deeper philosophical discussion of euthanasia. It's the same for the Buddhist view on euthanasia for animals or for people, is that the reason why they're suffering is because it's their karma that they're dying that way. Instead of having a nice, peaceful death, because they're going through that, they're experiencing the karma. So the problem is if you kill them out of compassion with euthanasia, you assume that it ends their suffering, right?
Mm.
But do you know it ends their suffering? The suffering could continue in the next realm. They could typically be reborn in the ghost realm for a while. The suffering might continue because it was their karma to die that way. So you should certainly have compassion for your little kitty cat, give them painkillers or whatever, for people to have compassion for them, ease their suffering. But euthanasia is not acceptable in Buddhism. In fact, if a monk were to agree to that and someone committed euthanasia, a monk would be disrobed for life, could never be allowed into monkhood again because it's killing or contributing to killing.
So are these the kind of philosophical conversations you have at your sleepover parties?
That's right.
I'm totally calling it a party. It's not a party.
it's a silent retreat. Like we talk during like discussion time, lecture. The rest of the time is like a silent meditation retreat. Yeah, we'll be doing an all-nighter this Saturday night from 8 to 11. Be there out in 264 Street, Alder Grove at 62 Avenue. That's the Laotian Monastery.
Wonderful. And terraveda.ca is where you can get more information about that if you want to go to the not sleepover party. You actually have to be quiet. That would not be an appropriate sleepover party for me to attend.
Come, Marie.
Okay, well, it is time for another break. This is Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and right now we are speaking with Brian Rue. He is the author of A Short Walk on an Ancient Path and Freeing the Buddha, Diversity on a Sacred Path, Large-Scale Concerns. And you can also find him at terraveda.ca. And if you want to see some of his meditations and the discussions on karma and rebirth, you can go to his YouTube page, youtube.com/Brian Rue. His last name is spelled R-U-H-E, Brian Rue. So we will be back with more synchronicity in a moment. Thank you.
AMS Food Bank. Your access to money during the studies at UBC will most likely be limited, but it is a priority of the AMS Food Bank to ensure your access to food is not. The AMS Food Bank provides emergency food relief 7 days a week for all UBC students. To volunteer with the food bank or for inquiries about how to take advantage of the services provided, contact them at foodbank@ams.ubc.ca. For more information, find the AMS Food Bank on Facebook or feel free to visit anytime. Across from the Wellness Center and Sprouts.
Old or New Testament?
I think the New Testament.
The question is, Pilate. Remember Pilate from the New Testament?
Pontius Pilate. He fiddled while...
Yeah, no, well, just a minute. Let me ask the question, then you can give me the answer, okay? Did Pilate want Jesus to be crucified?
Pontius Pilate washed his hands of it.
So did he want him to be crucified?
Yeah.
No. No. No.
Well, tune in every Friday afternoon, 3:30 to the Night Watch Show. What's in ya?
Well, find a good church. It'll help you.
Welcome back to Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and we are speaking with Brian Rue. You can find him at terraveda.ca. And during the break, we were actually just talking about the whole vegetarian discussion, and I had mentioned that one day on Facebook, I was feeling grateful, and I posted thanks to an animal that I had eaten. I thanked the animal for, you know, giving its life for my ability to eat it and survive, and it got into this very heated discussion about how, well, the animal didn't give its life because it was taken and all of that. So let's talk a little bit about that, because so many different people, different religions, there's just so many philosophical viewpoints on eating what the food that you should eat. I mean, even for me, I feel like, well, plants feel death as well on some level. So, I mean, you can't say that it's better to eat plants than animals, in my opinion. So how do you know what for you is the right decision to make when there's so many different viewpoints?
That's right. I guess I feel fortunate. So I have one particular view, the Theravada Buddhist worldview, which is quite thorough, because so like a lot of different spiritual views clash with each other, so people are going to get into arguments. But just a comment on your situation, say if you kill the animal, you know, and what you can do, a Buddhist practice is called dedication of merit. You can dedicate the merit, you know, to the animal. So any good deed you've done, you know, or any, like, say, an act of merit, like, say, doing a meditation practice or whatever, you just say, mentally dedicate the merit of this to the chicken. So you could actually send some good vibes to the chicken from a Buddhist view. It's typically what we would do, say, if a relative dies, you know, someone passes away, after they die, you mentally dedicate merit to them to give them a boost. So the idea is you're giving them kind of sending them a care package into the ghost realm. Because most people, it seems, they spend some time in the ghost realm after they die, and then they come back to the human realm. So same with animals. You could, you know, with the chicken, you can dedicate some merit to the chicken. So at least it's something you do. But yeah, from a Buddhist view, there's still some negative karma if you kill yourself. In Thailand, they have a perfect relationship. They have about like 2 or 3% Muslim population, 95% Buddhist population. So the butchers in Thailand are the Muslims, you see. So the Thais don't have to kill themselves, you see. It's not a problem for Islam to kill the animals.
Well, that's a good bargain they've got worked out there, then.
Yeah, a good religious harmony in that regard.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. So, I mean, I guess it's interesting when you were talking about how the Buddha, like, I mean, it seems like he just decided all this stuff was true and then told people. So, I mean, what gives him the authority? And I'm not knocking Buddha or anything, but I'm just like...
Well, you don't have to be a Buddhist. That's fine, you know.
But what, in your opinion, gives him the authority to say, well, this is right?
Well, I think it's the enlightenment of the Buddha, some that mystery of his actual enlightenment when he was 35 years old. He broke through his highest state, nirvana. But I think his teachings, he did say his teachings are verifiable and they're timeless. So in his lifetime, thousands of people attain enlightenment as well, called arahants, you know, monks and nuns, sometimes even kids attain enlightenment. So they would verify this cosmological view and this view of karma from their own direct perception. So it wasn't like we're just taking the Buddha's word for it. Other people have verified that from their own experience.
Okay, yeah. So they all get to enlightenment, and then they're able to, from that perspective, see the truth.
Yeah, I mean, some would see it more clearly than others, but yeah, they would have that same realization.
Okay.
Yeah.
But then what if other people, they feel like they've attained some level of enlightenment, and that's their view?
Good point,
it's different,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, so from Buddhist view, we would teach, the Buddha even said in the future that we can teach someone or test someone's enlightenment or their teachings is to just carefully compare it to the suttas, what the Buddha taught. And if it's in harmony with that, you can take it as the teachings of Buddha. If it contradicts that, you'd have to reject it. So if other people claim that they're enlightened, and some Western spiritual teachers call themselves enlightened, so... What definition are they using, I wonder? The Buddhist definition is very, very high definition. Like, actually, no one in the world today is recognized as enlightened, at least in the Theravada Buddhist world, officially recognized enlightened.
It's not even like the Dalai Lama or anything?
No, in fact, the Dalai Lama, he claims that he's not enlightened. He tells people he's not enlightened because many people just assume that he is. So Dalai Lama is being quite honest about it. So when spiritual teachers say that they're enlightened, I think, well, they must have had some kind of insight or breakthrough, but it's an exaggeration to actually call it like the big E word, enlightened, from a Buddhist, you know, some people, if they're from a Advaita Vedanta or Hindu tradition, their definition of enlightenment might be different.
Okay, so a few weeks ago, I have some friends, I'm actually going tomorrow night to see someone at their house, some guru, but they have a book called The One Great Year, about the great year cycle, and they say that right now we're actually in the middle, we're just kind of coming out of a dark age.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, I don't know what your views are, but back when Buddha lived, all these people were enlightened,
yeah.
And then we went through all these like dark ages. Could that be part of why there aren't any enlightened people on the planet right now?
Well, I think the Buddha is similar to that. I think the way the Buddha described it is he described eras almost like a wave that goes up. We have this kind of a golden utopian era. Everyone's living within the precepts. You know, people are getting enlightened. And then it starts to go down. It bottoms out to total corruption in the world. And then it comes back up again. This over periods of hundreds of thousands of years or tens of thousands of years. Yeah, so it does actually go like that. So I think Buddha would explain, like, today... where maybe a second or third string merit people. Or during the time of the Buddha, there's thousands of people who were close to enlightened, and they would meet the Buddha, poof, they'd get enlightened within a week or two, or go to one talk, poof, they'd get enlightened. Whereas those high merit type people who took rebirth then in India, they're gone now. So we're like for the second or third string level
so
people.
So did these people just have like super good karma and they got enlightened and now they're like on some other happy plane and we're here dealing with all the crap?
Well, actually, I can show you on page 123 of Short Walk Nature Path. Yeah, this shows the realms of existence.
Ah.
We should have visual aids on a radio, I guess. But yeah, Nirvana does transcend. These are like the six... or five realms of existence.
So samsara, what's the line of samsara?
Yeah, samsara means the whole pie graph. Basically, okay. The realms, the three lower realms are ghost, animal, and hell. And the two higher realms are human and the god realm, which is devas. These are the angels, spelled D-E-V-A, deva, angels. So So if they're fully enlightened, though, they would have gone to nirvana, which even transcends heaven. It transcends the idea of the God realm, the Davis heaven. Enlightenment is beyond that.
Oh, so nirvana is like, okay, so we've got this circle of like the lower realms and then the higher realms, which includes jealous gods. I think that's funny.
That's right.
And then nirvana is up here.
My ex-girlfriend is here in the jealous god realm. You know, girls are so catty.
That's funny.
I'm I'm cruel to say that. I mean, guys are just as bad.
All right. So did it feel good to get a little jab in at your ex-girlfriend on the radio?
That seems like bad karma right there.
I think earned some bad karma points.
You know, I learned in education, and I've been teaching at the Vancouver School Board for 16 years, and they say that the cardinal sin in education is to be boring. You know, you got to have some humor. You got to spice it up.
Okay. So maybe she doesn't mind being the source of your humor.
I hope not. Yeah.
No. She knows it's good karma for her.
She'll never know.
does she get the points? So when you send your good karma to like the chicken or your dying relative, does that mean like you have like this bank account of karma and you've done all these good things, so you've given some of your karma away to them?
Well, actually, when you dedicate merit to someone, it's kind of like if you have a candle and you light another candle, it makes your candle brighter.
Oh.
So it's actually an act of merit itself just to transfer your merit to others.
Oh, so you don't lose any.
You don't lose
You're not giving it
that's
up.
Right.
You're making more. Oh,
I should
that's
mention,
nice.
There's a good essay on my website at terabod.ca about it called The Significance of the Transference of Merit to the Departed. It's written by a Sri Lankan monk, Dhammananda. So it's right on my website.
Cool.
About transference of merit. It's certainly something Buddhist and pop, almost every tradition would do. If somebody dies, you want to send them some good vibes, you know, transference of merit.
Nice. And what about like the jerky people of the world? Should you send them? Like I try to send people love when I see people. Well, sometimes it's easier than other times. But if I see someone who is really angry or hateful, sometimes I try to send them love so that maybe they'll be a little less hateful towards the rest of the world.
Well, it's fine to do that. But I know like in the loving kindness guided meditation, if you're sending loving kindness to like a difficult person or to a neutral person, generally they're not really feeling it. They're objects you use in your own mind as a training for yourself to train your own mind to have more loving kindness, more friendliness, goodwill. So it's not likely they're going to really feel it if you try to send it to them. I know people like to do that. You'd like to send loving kindness to someone. Maybe. In fact, the Buddhist teachings say that if you have really deep concentration, there's these absorption states called jhana, meditation absorption. If you're really deep, and then you send loving kindness to someone, you know, they might actually feel it because of the power of your mind.
Mm. But there's also like the free will of that person, right? I mean, it's not really our place to affect their choices, right?
That's right. I mean, whatever you can do for them, you know, it's nice to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. So do you want to talk about the Eightfold Path or do a guided meditation first?
Oh, gee.
We only have 45 minutes or 15 minutes left.
Maybe we can do the guided meditation first. And then.
All right.
Yeah. About 5 minutes, something like that.
Okay. I'll let you lead the way.
Okay. I can describe what it means first. It's called Metta, which is M-E-T-T-A, and which is a Pali word for... Basically, it translates as goodwill, but it's usually translated as loving kindness. So it's a meditation that the Buddha taught. It's also something like I'll be doing on the retreat, doing all of my classes. It's a very common, highly recommended practice. And the idea is the main antidote to anger is this feeling of friendliness, goodwill. So you're trying to displace your anger in your mind with this friendliness, you know, loving kindness, benevolence. Buddha said you should extend it first to objects that are easy for yourself, like to yourself, and then to a very dearly loved friend, and then a neutral person, and then a difficult person. That's kind of the range. Although you could spend the whole time sending to, you know, easy objects, even to your pet cat or a dog or something like that. So it's really nice, warm, kind of touchy-feely guided meditation, repeating phrases like maybe well, happy, peaceful. And you can visualize objects that conjure up that feeling. So there's no particular rules for how to do it, just whatever works for you, you know. So we can do a short one. Yeah, so the listener at home, they can take the posture. Get this actually sit upright. Try not to lean back. If you lean back, you tend to fall asleep. And then, yeah, just take your posture comfortably and then close your eyes. And then you can bring your attention to your heart, to your heart center. Feel a sense of gentleness, softness, loving kindness. And then think of all of the people who love you. You could even include old friends you haven't seen in decades. And think of them standing around you here, feeling their presence here. And imagine them sending their loving kindness to you. And then join your aspirations with theirs and overspread yourself with this friendliness, goodwill, loving kindness, wishing, may I be happy. May I find true happiness. And realize the rightness of your wish to be happy. Your happiness doesn't take away happiness from others. And the more happiness you have, the more you share. And dissolve away any ill will toward yourself. You realize you have gentleness and goodness in you already. You don't have to be hard on yourself. And smile to invoke that feeling of happiness. You could even visualize yourself sitting in a hot tub filled to your chin with this white, warm, luminous liquid, loving kindness, dissolving away your anger and your tension. Imagine floating in that tranquil space, feeling the best you've ever felt. And then extend that loving kindness outwards to a very dearly loved friend or a family member, wishing may they be happy, may they find true happiness as well. Imagine them sitting right in front of you, feeling their presence. Imagine that they're extending loving kindness to you. And you're exchanging that feeling back and forth. And then spread that loving kindness further to your family and friends, those nearest and dearest to you. Wish them happiness, wish them peace. And then extend it outwards to more neutral persons like acquaintances, neighbors, strangers, people you meet in shops. Give your loving kindness to everyone, without thought of your relationship to them. Then you can spread it by direction around the neighborhood, across the city, north and south, east and west, like a thick blanket of loving kindness, a mile thick, saturating all beings with friendliness, love, goodwill. And you can chant to yourself, may all beings be well, happy, and peaceful. May all beings be well, happy, and peaceful. And then bring that loving kindness back to yourself. Feel yourself like a vessel filled to the top. This white, warm, luminous friendliness, loving kindness, wishing may I be happy, may I find true happiness. And then you can dissolve the contemplation and open your eyes. particularly if you're driving a car right now. You should be opening your eyes at this point.
Keep them open the whole time, yes. Can you do still, you could still do a little bit of loving kindness with your eyes open, right? I was sort of having to keep track of all the stuff here, so I had my eyes open, but.
Yeah, it's fine. In fact, the Buddha, he never specified whether the eyes should be open or closed. You know, when you see these statues of the Buddha, it looks like his eyes are looking down, just open a crack. So generally in the Theravada tradition, we keep them closed, so there's less sensory distraction, but there's no rule about it. Yes, yeah, so loving kindness is something you can even go in and out of throughout the day, like with breath meditation. Do a few minutes here, a few minutes there. You know, it's good to sit for maybe 20 minutes or 30 minutes a day, but just whenever you have time, a few minutes in here and there is good.
Cool.
Yeah. So now you're healed.
Healed. Magic. Oh, I've reached enlightenment. If we were, so if this was back in the Buddha days, maybe we'd already be enlightened. After 5 years of hosting this show, I should damn
maybe
well
it would
be
back in
500
BC. Who knows? Yeah. But that was the heyday, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So do we have time to talk about the Eightfold Path? Coming up in a few minutes here on CITR is Parts Unknown with DJ Chris Arific. So stick around for that. Do we have time to talk about Eightfold?
We could talk about it's divided into three stages, a more basic way of like the eight are divided into three parts of the path.
Okay.
Yeah. The first is, the three are virtue, then mental purification, and insight and wisdom. So it's like Buddhism in summary. So virtue basically means living within ethics, like the precepts I referred to a bit before. Like the first is don't kill, don't steal, don't engage in sexual misconduct, don't lie, and try to avoid taking intoxicants, which cloud the mind and lead to moral carelessness, like alcohol or drugs. So that's really the foundation of your ethical behavior. And that's the basis on which you do your meditation practice. So metta purification basically means meditation. So meditation is kind of the fulcrum of the path. So if you have ethics as your basis, you can go deeper and deeper in your meditation progress. But without ethics, your meditation really can't go anywhere, you know. Mm. People won't really develop without that. So, you know, ethics or precepts can't be really emphasized enough. Now, the third stage of insight or wisdom is like a result of the process. So you can think of virtue as like the walls of the dam, and metta purification is like the water rising in the dam. So when you build that concentration of water rising to the top, then you use that power for electricity to light up the whole city. So that's the insight or wisdom. So that's the fruition of the whole path. So like full and complete enlightenment, nirvana, or the little insights and wisdom we gain in life. So really the whole Buddhist path is a do-it-to-yourself kind of project. Like you do need the teachings called the Dhamma or the Dharma. But there's no one with higher power judging over you in a Buddhist view. Like there's no idea of God actually in Buddhism, because nirvana is not personal. It's like an impersonal element that you, roughly speaking, merge into. So it's really up to you. The Buddha said, you're the master of your own destiny. You can practice these teachings with the three stages of virtue, mental purification, insight. And you can grow and develop with that. It's not dependent upon some higher power.
Cool. So the question I'm having now is like, so someone like Hitler, would he...
I've got a chapter actually in my book
called...
Well, chapter 13, part 2 of Freeing the Buddha is called Adolf Hitler and Tibetan Buddhism. It's just a theory, I was taught this by Tibetan Buddhists, that the Nazis were into channeling higher realm powers. They had this interest. They sent expeditions into Tibet every year since 1926, before they even came to power. They're that interested, that concerned about the higher realm powers that Tibetans could give them.
But like, so would someone like Hitler be reincarnated as a slug or something?
I guess he's a complex case, Hitler. I don't really know. It's easier for me to evaluate Joseph Stalin's actions. With 40 million dead in his country. Actually, I read that Mao Zedong even beats out Joseph Stalin as perhaps the biggest mass murder in human history. 80 million people.
Wow.
But Stalin is a bit more, I guess, vicious and deliberate about it. 40 million. Yeah, so from a Buddhist view, someone like Stalin would have to really take rebirth in the hell realm. Not a slug would be too good for Stalin.
Hmm.
Probably. That's so the logic of the realms, I know for many people, the idea of hell is unpopular, you know. And if your friends convince you it doesn't exist, you take a survey and 82% vote that hell doesn't exist if you're reassured. However, it's not logical to assume that hell does not exist merely because it's unpopular.
Hmm.
So you have to look at it logically. From Buddhist logic of karma, really good people can go up to higher realms, heaven or higher humanverse, and really evil people can go down to the lowest levels of hell. There's a full range.
But yeah. What if you don't believe in hell? Like, I don't necessarily believe in heaven. I believe that you can create your own hell in this existence and your own enlightenment.
Hey, am I that bad of a guess that you feel like you're in a hell? I'm tough guess.
No. So what did Chris walk into now? He's getting ready for his exit.
Yeah, I agree. You could create a heaven or a hell as a mental state of mind.
Yeah.
But the Buddhist teachings are literal about what happens after death. You can say, sure, in this lifetime, it's a hell, whatever. The economy's pretty bad. But after death, from a Buddhist view, because the extreme ranges of people's karma, they could, like, say Mother Teresa, she could have a heavenly rebirth. She helped thousands of people, save lots of lives. She could go to heavenly rebirth. Or someone like Joseph Stalin could go to a hell realm. But I was actually on Joy TV. They did an episode of The Search. And I said that our hell is better than the Catholic hell. Because the Catholic hell is everlasting damnation. Whereas with the Buddhist lifespans, all of them are impermanent. So you might just be in hell for a while, maybe in a few weeks.
Well, but that's like Catholic purgatory. Catholic has purgatory.
Yeah.
So...
Actually, I think there's considerable evidence, or some evidence, that the Catholic purgatory came from the Buddhist ghost realm teachings. Because the ghostly state is kind of like a purgatory. It's an in-between heaven and hell. And even though this was invented at the Second Council of Constantinople in 556 AD, they invented purgatory at that point. They voted on it. They constructed it at that time. So my teacher, Ajahn Sona, I should mention my main teacher lives at the Birka Forest Monastery. He's convinced that the Catholics created purgatory from the Buddhist ghost realm teachings. Because Buddhism was known even before the Christian religion.
Of course, yeah.
In the West, yeah.
Well, that's all the time we have today, actually, Brian. So you're welcome back on the show anytime because it's been a fascinating discussion.
Again, we'll solve all the world's problems next time.
Awesome.
And all you're those chickens and cows, we'll take care of them next time.
Okay, fabulous. Okay, so that was... That was Brian Rue. He is the author of A Short Walk on an Ancient Path, as well as some other books, and also has a YouTube page and all of that. So you can find him at terraveda.ca, and you can find more information about this show on my website, spiritualshow.com, and I'll also, when I get around to updating my website, I'll put a link to his website on mine. And coming up next here on CITR is Parts Unknown. I just want to send you lots of love. I love you so much. And send some loving kindness out to everyone today, because that was lots of fun. And I will see you next week. Be well. Namaste.
$1 billion on the ground, all stretched out. And